Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hey, pull up a chair. It's Hacks on Tap with David Axelrod, Robert Gibbs, and Mike Murphy.
If I lose to him, I don't know what I'm going to do. I will never speak to you again. You'll never see me again.
So, Mike Murphy, there's another campaign promise that will probably go unfulfilled.
Well, I'm hoping. I'm a believer.
Promises made, promises kept, guys.
And that is John Heilman. John Heilman, our old buddy back from the circus trail. Good to see you guys. 2 weeks out.
Here we are.
Murphy, how confident are you that Trump will have to try and keep his pledge to never talk to us again and maybe leave the country?
Well, you never say never in the lunatic bin of modern American politics, but it looks pretty damn bad. And, you know, I am emboldened in my prediction by
that means it looks bad for him.
Yeah, it looks bad for the Trump.
You keep doing this. We were talking about this
before. I'm doing
before,
the inside. So. I'm seeing if you're awake, and more coffee for you. More coffee. The thing that has me emboldened is the brilliant. I mean, it is, you know, Rommel would have said, damn, this guy's good closing strategy that Trump has of attacking Tony Fauci. If that won't put the race away, I don't know what will. But yeah, it looks pretty good. Florida's close. Trump's making a last stand there, and it's close. North Carolina, Trump's got some muscle there. But again, Biden is playing on Trump's backfield. Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, with a big asterisk about slow vote count, all look pretty strong. And Arizona.
Heilman, to this Rommel strategy that Murphy refers to.
That's my ode to Steve Schmidt. I'm going for the war analogy. So.
I don't know if were you or any of your group with Trump in Iowa when he made that speech. Have you guys been following him?
We have been, but we were not at that particular super spreader event. No.
So he goes to Michigan and he attacks Whitmer.
Yeah.
And mocks her for being the victim of a domestic terrorist plot. He goes to Wisconsin where they had 20,000 new cases of coronavirus last week and downplays the coronavirus. And then he caps it all off Monday with an all-day blitzkrieg on Tony Fauci.
Right. Winning. So
let's listen.
Winning.
Let's actually listen to the Fauci tape, and then I want you to react on the other side.
People are tired of hearing Fauci and all these idiots, these people that have gotten it wrong. Fauci's a nice guy. He's been here for 500 years. Every time he goes on television, there's always a bomb. But there's a bigger bomb if you fire him. But Fauci's a disaster.
Somebody's mad about 60 Minutes.
Yeah. I'll tell you what people are tired of. People are tired of his infantile outbursts. And I'll tell you, you know, we're 2 weeks out and I'm tired of sounding like a broken record. But I do think, you know, in this last moment here, we've got this poll that just came out, this New York Times national poll just came out, in which Biden now leads on every attribute and has pulled the level with Trump on the economy, which has been the one thing that Trump has had a consistent lead on, right? That matters over the
course
of the year.
Which he never talks about or rarely talks about.
Yes. Well, and that's kind of my point is that, you know, the one place, you know, any sane campaign strategist, if you guys were running the Trump campaign, which is kind of akin to saying like if my dog could do higher math, but if you guys were running the Trump campaign, you'd be like, hey, do what you did in 2016, buddy. You know, let's talk about that. Spend the last 2 weeks talking about, you know, manufacturing and trade, and if you want the immigration, whatever, something. Talk about the economy where you have a lead. Instead, he's talking about the one issue on which he's been terminally disadvantaged for the entirety of the pandemic, the place where he's been gotten crushed, his approval ratings in the mid-30s, Biden's trusted by double digits ahead of him, on the one issue that we know if that's what the race is about, he's going to lose. And so he spends the whole time talking about himself, make it a referendum on me, and coronavirus, make it about the issue that I'm worst on. I mean, it's just madness.
Madness.
Yeah, you know, the Times did a poll in mid-September, and they asked who you trust on for information on the coronavirus. Scientists were like 90% or something. Fauci was 67%, despite the carpet bombing from Trump up to that point. Trump was 26%. So it's like, Murphy, the 26%, so who wakes up and says, I'm going to go after the 67% guy?
Yeah, look, again, we're all in Groundhog Day. I feel like every week we're like, yeah, Trump's still crazy. Campaign's still looking good for Biden. You know, Trump is in the bubble now where it's all about feeding his 43% new food and having rallies so, you know, he can get over his father and hearing applause. So this is, and this word is in the news now, so I feel like breaking it through on our family-friendly podcast. But Trump is running a masturbatory campaign. Mm-hmm. And it's all just about his insecurities. And even his guys, there's a great story in the AP today, you know, with some color and detail on how they blew through $1 billion. This whole thing has been a massive vanity crusade by a crooked family business. And, you know, amusingly, in some ways, despite all the endless antics, it's the most boring campaign in the history of the world. Trump's a monkey. He throws some shit at the audience. Cut to repeat. And, you know, it's just a matter of, I think, the clock grinding down. And, you know, maybe Trump will be able to close a little in the end, depending on this debate. But I think it's Palookaville for him.
But it's also just, you know, he's also doing the other thing that's the ultimate thing of political self-pleasuring, which is trying to replay the 2016 thing all over again. He is just the high school quarterback 30 years later, sitting there with the Budweiser in his hand, remembering the great, you know, touchdown that he threw, you know, to win the Division 2A, you know, playoff game in some suburb, you know, and he plays it over and over again. So now we're like with the Hunter Biden story. It's like, you know, back in 2016, it's crooked Hillary. Now it's crooked Joe. It was lock her up. Now it's lock him up. It's like, the monkey, not only just throws shit at the audience, but he's the organ grinder monkey who only knows one song. And he's like song. And this is like the out of key, minor key version of that song that has no resonance whatsoever when the country is in the kind of chaos it's in because of the virus and the economy and everything else.
Yeah, I watched him on Fox and Friends this morning. First of all, the irony of it was he was on a major league whine about how the media is so easy on Biden, and spent 45 minutes of the Fox and Friends people asking him just why he is so great. And why doesn't everybody see how great he is?
You know, Trump is kind of the inside out deal, because we've all had candidates who before the rally or the event, you know, bitch and moan to us about damn media. Why are they covering that son of a bitch? The ads are run. They get all their grievance stuff out and then they go out and they kill and do their thing. This guy is inside out, man. He does all the grievance that normally a campaign staff would hear. And to John's earlier point about a one hit wonder, that is so true. I used to live up in the Hollywood Hills, and my house had previously been owned by rock and roll god Lowell Cream of 10cc, who had gone off to a big career creating music. There's apparently
that's
a drug
huge, man. I didn't know that.
Buried under my old pool, according to Neil Diamond, saxophone player, this great guy who's unfortunately passed away, who lived across the street. Apparently, there was wet cement and a drug raid, and a bag went into the foundation. But anyway, putting all that aside,
this is a story we got to hear the longer version of. There's not enough time on this podcast for this story to really make it work.
We really got to get David Hill on, who is not only a Republican pollster, but was the, as a young grad student, he was the rock promoter who brought the Rolling Stones to Alabama. But to finish up,
to Planet Earth here.
I'm landing it now. You just got to give me a second. I would get mail from the old bass player, you know, Lowell gone off to London to invent music videos. Hey, I hear we got a gig we could get at the Fargo State Fair. Come on, let's put the group back together. And that's Trump. He just wants to remember the old hits and sing the songs. I think John's totally right about that, and we're going to watch that indulgence now forever.
For all of what we've said, and we've spent quite a few minutes ragging on Trump chances, I know. But you throw a rock and you can hit a Democrat who's in the fetal position right now.
Freaking out.
Yep.
I mean, you know, the only thing worse for Democrats than polls that show the race close are polls that show the race not close, right, because they all have PTSD, polling traumatic stress disorder from 2016. So, Murphy, tell our friends, put them at ease, tell them why this isn't 2016.
Well, first of all, your comment inspired me that we really ought to re-record the opening of this podcast and open with, boy, can you believe this tracking? It's unbelievable. The surge yeah. Trump is having, I think, you know, and just scared the shit out of people for 2 minutes.
Like War of the Worlds.
Yeah, do War of the Worlds, exactly. It, apparently, both Michigan and Wisconsin are now showing a Trump lead in the analytics. Look, the reason it's not 2016, there's so many, I'll be quick. First of all, Biden's a stronger candidate than Hillary. Second, Trump is the incumbent, so he can't be right. pissing at the castle. He is the castle. Right. Three, Trump is a novelty act that we've had for 4 years. How many people, the day after seeing Gallagher do the watermelon act, say, boy, I know what I'm going to do tomorrow night. I'm going to go buy Gallagher tickets. Nobody, not even to see his brother. There used to be two Gallaghers, a whole nother story. So, you know, Trump is kind of spent.
10cc and Gallagher in the same podcast.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, no, we're going for the deep
Murphy
dive
is stuck in this
today.
Time capsule, and yeah. I can't get him to move forward.
Ain't no Jaws of Life built that can pull me out of that. So to finish up, Trump is also unable to play the big Captain Nemo keyboard of being an incumbent president and harness all that power to pivot and move and do shit. Instead, he's just doing the old campaign we've seen before with a totally different context. And finally, Biden has been lucky. Biden is lucky, lucky, lucky man. He had the demographic stuff, and to their credit, they kept their wits together in the primary. But then he got to a African-American dominated state where his incredible connection there totally elevated him. They played it right, and he's been out of sight, letting Trump self-immolate because of the coronavirus. And when he's had to appear, he's been pretty good. So, you know, right. It's just a very different world. Now, could Trump win? Yes. Yeah. Will Trump win? Highly, highly unlikely.
Here's the two things that you... So Democrats, there are two kinds of bedwetting going on now. One kind of bedwetting is the traditional bedwetting, which is like, you know, the polls are... Maybe, you know, somehow Trump's going to do what he did in 2016. The polls will all be wrong. There's that bedwetting that Trump Biden might lose.
They believe that, and Trump's true believers believe that.
Right. 100%.
The secret poll.
100%. And then there's the other kind of bedwetting, which is, you know, Biden will win, but Trump will steal the election, which is a whole other topic. But there's a lot of that. Here are the two things that people seize on, I think, part just to try to, like, unpack why are Democrats freaking out. There is the 2016 PTSD, but there is also the rallies, right? And you know, we are all sophisticates, and we say, well, crowd size doesn't matter. But the reality is, you know, Barack Obama had giant, huge mega rallies, and it signified genuine enthusiasm. Donald Trump had mega rallies in 2016, and it signified real enthusiasm. It is the case now, if you're a Democrat, you look around, you look at Joe Biden's turnout when he does do the rare events that he does. And, you know, I've been on the road. I've seen them. They're not, people don't show up. Now, that could be because they're sensible Democrats who don't want to get coronavirus. There are a lot of reasons. They've all seen Joe Biden for years, and they know already that they're
or they don't
want to
infect
Trump.
The candidate.
Right. Or any of the above. But the reality is, if you're a Democrat looking around, the Trump people, the MAGA people, like, send you these pictures in social media. Look at these rallies. Thousands of people coming out. And Democrats are spooked by that. I'm not saying they should be, but they are. They're spooked by it. And the other piece of it is, if you're a sophisticate, the thing you're spooked by, and you hear it a lot in the last 10 days, is the registration numbers. And you see, you know, Tom Edsel writes a piece in the New York Times last week that points it out. But I've been seeing people circulating these registration numbers in our world for around the same period of time. So you look at, you know, the registration advantage of Democrats has narrowed in Florida over these cycles. Yeah. It's narrowed in North Carolina. It's narrowed in Pennsylvania. And so there are people who are sophisticates in our world who also look at those things. And to Mike, to your point about, they're not saying they think Trump's going to win, but they see some little tremors in the numbers like that on the registration thing and say, huh, maybe there's a little bit wider a path here than the conventional wisdom allows. I hear that all the time. And I'm actually, I'm about to raise the question to ask you guys, like, Why is it that people should write off the registration narrowing thing? What is the reason that you guys remain confident in the face of some actual data that would cause people and has caused some people to get nervous?
I'll take the first shot at it. There's some truth in it. It's also been the Trump strategy because they're trying to change the electorate because they know they're losing the electorate they got. They're also willing to go knock on doors in a pandemic. The Biden campaign in most places has not been. But people look at the registration thing as R versus D. And they're, wow, the R's are doing pretty well compared to the D. There are two other numbers you got to look at. One, the demographic change, because a lot of old R's are dying. And so, you know, the Republican, the if you look at it like water going into a pail, the Republican pail has a leak in it and the Democratic one doesn't demographically, because the older vote tends to be more old, white and R, the younger vote more multicultural. Second, keep a look at the third category, because in most places, Biden's going to win that third category, new independents, new other stuff, by 20 points or better. So you really have to look at D plus 2/3 of the I's against the R's, and then it flattens out in a pretty good way, and then the R's are losing old people faster than the D's are.
I agree with that analysis. You know, when we when I was with Obama and we beat both McCain and Romney, we had, I think, a 650,000 voter registration edge in the first race of 550, the second. It's down to in the hundreds. Now it's been shrunken, but the state is 3 points more diverse, than 4 years ago. And these NPA voters tend to be, for whatever reason, a lot of minority voters are now registering NPA, no party affiliation. So there are reasons to, you got to take that seriously, but, there are also offsetting factors. You know, John, on this, crowd thing, it reminds me of in 2008, you know, the McCain campaign started, jaked us into pulling our rallies down because our rallies were so so ostentatious.
Yeah.
And, you know, they did that whole he's a celebrity for no reason thing.
Yeah, after Berlin.
And we after stupidly, your Berlin thing. After
yeah.
Berlin.
Yeah.
So, it, yeah, 250,000 people in Berlin, nice crowd. But
I won't even go there with huge crowds in Germany, but go ahead. Were they chanting? Any torches?
Yes, we can. But I think so. I don't speak German. Anyway.
Si se puede.
But we pulled our crowds down. Then he picked Sarah Palin as his running mate. They start doing these huge rallies out of the convention, and we're still doing our little round tables and so on. We finally had a meeting and said, this is nuts. We're looking, we've got the momentum and he looks like he has the momentum.
Yeah.
And so that goes to your point about the rallies that Trump is having versus the Biden events.
Well, they're winning the optics on cable. I mean, bottom line is Trump, you see cheering people about to get a disease, and Biden, you see kind of slow and thoughtful. And that's just not optically how you like to close.
I think it's also the case, I'll stipulate something that I think is true, right? Which is that I don't think there's genuinely, like, I hate to say this, I don't think there's an enormous amount of it. I think there's a genuine enthusiasm gap. I don't think Biden voters are all that enthusiastic about Joe Biden particularly. I think they're super enthusiastic about getting Donald Trump out of the Oval Office.
Yeah, that's where enough. That's all you need.
The enthusiasm doesn't but you know what I'm saying, Mike? It's like those people don't need to go to a rally. Joe Biden's been around for a long time. They know he's an acceptable alternative. What they are enthusiastic about is getting rid of Trump. So it's kind of like, why would I go to a rally? Right. Why do I need to show that I'm enthusiastic
about
that?
Well, I'll tell you where they are showing up. They're showing up to freaking vote.
Vote.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Right. Their rally is their pen circling the dot that isn't Trump in early voting.
Right, and standing in those giant lines in Florida and Texas and
which
Georgia.
Is incredible, really, that
incredible.
People will wait 8 and 9 hours to vote. I mean, you know, the downside of it is no one in America should have to wait 8 or 9 hours to vote. On the other side of the equation is people are doing it. What does that tell you?
32 million people have voted at this point. And I remember having some conversations about this where Murphy was like, you know, people like to sit on their ballots. And I you know, they may still be sitting on their ballots, but 32 million people have voted as of this recording, and like compared to, I think, five at this same stage in 2016. I get all the factors, but it's just a stunning thing that 32 million people have voted at this phase in the process already. Stunning.
Well, it's a mix, though. It's enthusiasm and also the pandemic.
You yes, know, we, right.
you know,
of course.
The
yeah,
mix
course.
Is probably both.
It's both.
All right, let's take a minute to hear from one of our esteemed sponsors.
You know, Gibbs, every once in a while on Twitter, people will write in and say, Axe, you make me nauseous. But nausea's nothing to joke about.
It's like getting stuck in the back of a car and you're kind of a little bit hemmed in and you get that feeling and it starts in your stomach. It's not
yeah,
a good one.
And like you're on your way to something good, a celebration or party or something, and now you're nauseous and you can't get rid of it, except there is an answer now. And it's called Relief Band. Tell us about Relief Band.
Relief Band is the number one FDA-cleared anti-nausea wristband that has been clinically proven to quickly relieve and effectively prevent nausea and vomiting associated with motion sickness, anxiety, migraines, hangovers, morning sickness, chemotherapy, and so much more.
The product is 100% drug-free, non-drowsy, and provides all natural relief with zero side effects, zero, for as long as needed. The technology was originally developed over 20 years ago in hospitals to relieve nausea from patients, but now through Relief Band, it's available to all of us.
Here's how it works with Relief Band. It stimulates a nerve in the wrist that travels to the part of the brain that controls nausea. Then it blocks the signal your brain is sending to your stomach, telling you that you're sick. Relief Band is the only over-the-counter wearable device that has been used in hospitals and oncology clinics to treat nausea and vomiting. If you know somebody who deals with nausea, Relief Band makes a great gift.
I'm telling you, Relief Band works. We know from our own experience. We sent one to our engineer, who often gets nauseous during our shows, and he reports 100% cure.
Don't fall for those cheap bands you see in drugstores or on your Instagram feed.
All right.
Right now, Relief Band has an exclusive offer just for our Hacks listeners. If you go to reliefband.com and use promo code HACKS, you'll receive 20% off plus free shipping and a no questions asked 30-day money-back guarantee.
So head to reliefband, R-E-L-I-E-F-B-A-N-D, .com and use our promo code HACKS for 20% off plus free shipping. So let me ask you guys this. The pandemic is on the march again, and particularly in the north where it's getting colder. Those three states, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, what does that mean? I mean, is that should, first of all, will that stop people from going out and voting early? Will it drive them to mail votes? And, you know, if this continues for two more weeks, what does it mean in terms of turnout at the polls? And could that end up actually hurting Trump, that he encouraged people to go to the polls? And now the pandemic has resurfaced.
It could, because it looks like a spike in the kind of winter states. But, you know, it's hard to calculate. Maybe people just try to vote by mail more, which is a little more of a novelty in Michigan and Wisconsin than it is in other places. They're also going to have slower counts because they're election day count states. So, but I think it's got to have an impact. I'm not sure what it is. So if you're a Trump, you know, field operator, you're thinking, oh, hell, why did we declare a holy jihad on voting by mail? Because our suburbanites during a surge, or our rurals, I should say, having blown the suburban vote in many ways, you know, I don't know if they're going to want to brave a pandemic that's 25% worse than it is today on Election Day. So I'd be worried if I were them about this.
There's going to be incredible PhD dissertations written about this in years to come. Someone told me the other day that they knew someone who was like an out of work baseball statistical analyst, a sabermetrician who had taken up the cause of looking at doing regression analyses in the battleground states and maybe even CD by CD, looking at infection rates and Trump's poll numbers. And
so what do they say? Hit or steal? Did they
give us a bunt? And they said, you know, that there was an amazing correlation that every time infection rates went up in a really granular way. And of course, this is obvious at the macro level, but it's fascinating to me at the micro level that in places where the infection rates would go up, there would be downward pressure on Trump's poll numbers. And the data was bearing that out, which we all understand at the macro level is true. When the coronavirus is getting worse, it's bad for Trump. But I think it's to your point, David, there's these questions about what it will do to turnout. But I think it does exert downward pressure on Trump in those states. The fact that Iowa, Minnesota, and the three, you know, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, all of those states are on the brink of a massive surge in this last 2 weeks, which I can't figure out any angle by which that's good for Trump. Like, what? There's no world in which it's a positive thing for Donald Trump.
Well, and again, happening. You know, his showing up in all these states and making a point of downplaying the virus and you know, castigating the scientists and so on. I mean, it's just like spectacularly tin-eared. You know, he plays to the crowd in front of him.
Oh, totally. It's back to the bubble of self-pleasure.
stands up there and spits. He spits on a MAGA hat and throws it at people.
It is all about his, quote, his people he feels a loyalty to. And so he wants to go out and meet him in hockey arena. It's kind of like Goldwater. You know, when you have passion, it's great, but that may not be enough people.
Murphy, as one who's fleeced a lot of clients over the years, I want to ask you about the television situation here. I've always been of the mind that TV is of lesser importance in a presidential race just because of the volume of coverage mm-hmm. it gets. But it is probably valuable in reaching those really, really hard to reach voters in the kind of crevices of the electorate, you know, watching Andy of Mayberry at 3 a.m. and a smart campaign is going to seek them out using analytics to do it. But it is true that, you know, Biden has a 2-to-1 edge in television spending in the second, going into the second week of the campaign. What does it mean?
One, I agree. In a presidential campaign, normally it's the earned media is the most important, but paid ads let you go into a couple of states and get a third message out where you can really push the voters around without, you know, the cable TV filters and everything. So I think the Trump, and there's a great AP story about the billion they blew that came out today with some detail, is hilarious. I mean, it's unbelievable. I have a quote in a story that 10 monkeys with flamethrowers cannot burn through cash in a stupider way than they did.
Okay, that's a good quote if you do say so yourself.
Well, yeah. I thought just in case you missed it, I wanted to put it
no
in
need
front
to read
you.
The story. Now you got the essence of
right,
it. Right.
Now
there.
You're a celebrity journalist. You don't have to read the actual clips. But I think it saved Biden's ass in September because a Trump comeback strategy would have been a September offense and a good convention, September offense to put the spotlight on Biden, capped by a great debate on the 29th, and then close the gap in October. But Biden in September was able to flood the airwaves. Trump was broke, out-wrestle him on TV, and hold the line and burn up the clock. And then Trump, of course, had the worst debate ever. Now we're in a position where Trump is pulling ads down. Basically, Florida and a few other places are kind of his fortress. And he's still getting beat on the air. And in other places where he's vulnerable, that he ought to win, the Ohio's of the world, the Iowa's, he's out. And in Michigan, he's underfunded. So, you know, and Trump, because you can't, the Trump folks cannot trust their candidate to carry a coherent message other than yell at the TV, except yell at the audience thinking they're the TV that he's upset with. They don't have any tools. They've done some damage to Biden in Florida, where they've spent some money. They pounded him on, of all things, Social Security, and they've closed that gap a little bit. I mean, there are a few places where Trump television can make a difference. There's just not nearly enough of it because of all the spending incompetence. So, you know, it's the same story.
They're a little better than being there. I think Biden has just about a 2-to-1 lead in Florida, which is smaller than what he's had in some other states. I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling. He's, you know, it's a 3-to-1 deficit in Michigan, which tells you, I think, what Trump thinks his chances are there. But also 2.5-to-1 in Wisconsin. I mean, these are fairly significant. One interesting thing is they've both sort of gone dark. Biden has a few ads up in Ohio, but Mike, both of you guys, you're both television guys. You know, it's interesting. And Mark Caputo had a good story about this in Politico. The Biden campaign has bought a lot of national TV because the cost of local television stations in these battleground states has gone through the roof. It's more cost effective to buy nationally.
When you get to enough takeoff states, which are going to be the big 5 or 6, plus the 3 or 4 you're hoping for, the Georgias, the Ohios, all of a sudden, particularly for national TV that has demographic efficiency like football, you do much better buying the country, and you basically get the country for free on top of the states you want because those spot markets are all bit up crazy. You also have IE groups like Republican Voters Against Florida. We're up around 9 million in spending there.
No. Not Republican Voters Against Florida.
Republican Voters Against Florida.
That's always been true. Republican Voters Against Trump, rvet.org, still taking contributions. In Tampa and Jacksonville, and there's a whole crazy war in Orlando, you know, the groups that aren't candidates are in there, and it kind of bids up. That's why, and frankly, a lot of them will be vanishing by the 28th or 29th, because so much that early vote will be flooding in, and the pricing gets so crazy the last 10 days that the work is kind of done. But your point is right. The national stuff has great efficiency if you got the money, and they do.
It is interesting to me that the one state, there are two states, I guess, where Trump is outspending, and Trump and affiliated groups are outspending Biden. One is North Carolina, and the other is Georgia. Both, you know, North Carolina is tight as a tick. Georgia is my blue plate special. I think Georgia could be a breakthrough state. And you know, I'm not one who chases, there's fool's gold in presidential politics. Yeah.
He doesn't go chasing rainbows. You don't.
But there are all kinds of reasons to believe that Biden could win Georgia.
And I plug Ohio. I think they're very similar.
I say one just thing, just to put a button on this, is that it goes back to the conversation we were having before about enthusiasm. And I think really, you know, the other place we were saying, you know, they don't show up for the Biden rallies, but they are showing up to vote. The other place where you can really measure Democratic enthusiasm is the money. And the money has just been stunning, not just the presidential level. Joe Biden he was out banging a tin cup. He was the worst of the major candidates, of the A candidates that ran for the Democratic nomination, is that the worst fundraising operation, was cash poor for the whole nomination fight. You know, had to get that little super PAC together to keep him in business in the fall of 2019. And now they have become this juggernaut. And it just is, I think, again, a reflection of this overwhelming Democratic desire to get Trump out. And you see it obviously spilling over in these Senate races, where, you know, you look at Jamie Harrison and some of these other Democratic candidates that are just it's stunning how much money they have. Staggering.
They cannot spend it. Yes. The money they have, because it is so far in excess of anything they expected to raise. And there's a limit to what you can buy.
And there's an irony to it, though. I think the Biden guys have run a smart campaign, other than maybe the economic stuff. But I give them an A+. But if they'd had a lot of money early, the odds are they might have spent it. You know, it is a weird thing where being broke made them smart, in effect, because they were forced to hold the money till the end. Well, the Trump guys did the opposite because they had the luxury of all that cash, and they weren't smart.
There's no question that Trump is a fundraising machine for Democrats, as he would probably love us to acknowledge. But there is a question of whether, I mean, it seems to me that this could be kind of a historic tipping point here. I mean, the idea that all over the country, Democratic challengers are outraising Republican incumbents.
And not by a little, by a lot.
Sometimes 5-1.
Yes.
Sometimes
yes.
5-1.
Look at Jamie Harrison. It's incredible.
And the question is, will that continue? Are we at a different, has American politics shifted? And do Democrats now have a fundraising advantage that is institutionalized because they have the ability to raise small dollars? Or will Republicans catch up?
Well, and I would say that, you know, you think about the history of that, you know, you start with Obama, you know, that kind of gave birth to, you know, small dollar online fundraising. You then go to Sanders, you know, the next step in the innovation. And now ActBlue is maybe the most powerful organization, it could be the most powerful organization in politics, that's more powerful than the Democratic Party. I mean, they're just, that is a transformative thing, that there is now a highly efficient, highly effective central clearinghouse for small dollar donations for people where they can get their money into Democratic and other progressive causes. It's like changed the face of politics. And I think it's right. I mean, there's no IP in there that's not copyable in theory by Republicans. But the reality is, the Republican Party, I mean, besides Trump, who is obviously a brand unto himself, you look at the rest of the Republican Party. Who is there in the Republican Party that is, you need a brand, you need the kind of candidate, you need a Barack Obama, you need a Bernie Sanders, you need a Donald Trump in reverse to drive that kind of, to drive small dollar donations. And you look at the Republican, who, Marco Rubio is going to be that person? You know, Nikki Haley is going to be that person? I don't think so.
The ActBlue thing is so important because, and to translate for our hackeroos a little bit, it allows basically your credit card number to live in a place so you can give low dollar with an easy click instead of filling out 28 things and all your information every time, which makes it gives it a lot of friction, as the tech kids would say. So ActBlue allows me to get an email from some crank Democratic candidate, yeah, I'm on board, and do a click and $50 flies. And
right.
Now the Republicans have one. They've done they have an impersonator, but it's not nearly as much of an ecosystem as the Dems have built over the last couple of cycles. And it's really democratized fundraising. The other thing is you make a lot more money. In the old direct mail days, you're spending 80 cents to raise a dollar, best case. Now you're spending 7 cents to raise a dollar or less.
This is, you know, obviously there are big things going on here, but when the smoke clears, this is going to be a huge story about American politics.
Totally.
Okay, then let's take a break right here, and we'll be right back. So, debate coming up this Thursday.
What?
Trump was whining about it on Fox and Friends about how unfair it is and how they've changed the rules, and it was supposed to be all about national security and foreign policy, and now it's not. Don't know that necessarily benefits him.
As if Trump's going to care what the topics are. He's just going to say whatever he's going to say anyway.
And he's obviously unhappy because they can
mute him during
Biden's 2-minute answers. But it seems like the last big hurdle here. I mean, I'm not sure that anything that happens, 40 million people will have voted by that time. I think, you know, 95-98% of Americans have made up their minds. So what do you guys think is at stake on Thursday night?
For the neurotic Democratic world, it'll just be a sleepless night. I would say skip it. You know, why? Will Trump be better? I don't think it's a grip on the campaign. As you say, early votes surging ahead. People are locked in. The question is, can Trump do anything different? And should Biden change up his act a little bit? But it's all at the margins now. I don't see, unless Biden starts calling Trump Roosevelt and tries to engage him in a conversation and forgets who he is, and, you know, 23 Skidoo. What about that new color television coming in? I was watching Dumont the other night. You know, I mean, maybe Biden could blow the whole thing. It's not impossible. A quick trivia point. I did hear a candidate once say multiple times, and it really endeared him to me. He was a great patriot. He's still with us. Senator Bob Dole used to say, by Jiminy, which I thought was just great. Yeah,
probably not going to happen in this debate.
Well, Biden might.
You know what? I just the question is, John, does Trump, I mean, he obviously last time he was hyperbolically trying to shake Biden up, and
yes,
the interruptions were
yes,
a part of that. Is he going to be less so this way? I mean, things have advanced to the point where he knows in irrational moments, he must know that he's in a bit of a jam here. Does he know that he screwed himself last time by being such an ass, or
right,
does he tone it down, or does he double down?
What do we know? Here's a known thing, which is that everybody around Trump has been telling him that he has to be different, and that he screwed up the first debate, and that they probably won't say it quite that bluntly, but that he needs to, as they would put it, you know, give Biden enough rope to hang himself, and he needs to not interrupt, because, you know, that's when Biden's going to show that he's addled and doddering and senile, and Trump can't interrupt him, and maybe the mute button will help him, and they're trying to get him to be different. Does Trump think that he screwed up the first debate? Not on any available evidence. Like, you look at the way
he said today on Fox and Friends that they got a lot of good notice on that first debate.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, does Trump, if his advisors had their wishes, you know, Trump would be different. If Trump, they're not going to get their wishes, they never do. So Trump thinks he did great in that first debate, just like, you know, everything, you know, there's no sense in which Trump thinks he needs to change course. And I think, you know, if you, just on the basis of how he's campaigning, it suggests that course correction is not like front of mind for him. And you just said this thing, David, that I think is, you know, telling, right? Which is, you know, an irrational moment. He must know it's not working for him. I just don't think there's no available evidence to suggest that rational moments are occurring right now in Donald Trump's head. He's not campaigning like a rational person.
Trump will scratch any itch he has. And every day he wakes up with one itch: kill Biden. Got to kill Biden. Biden between me and toy I want. Kill Biden. So I think he will do like 6 minutes of thoughtful Trump, and then his head will explode, and we'll be right back where we were. There will be a new tactic, though. There is a button on Biden's forehead, Hunter Biden, and that kind of bullshitting New York Post story.
Yeah, no, I think this is big.
Biden popped off at a CBS reporter. Let's listen to the quick clip of Joe having an Irish temper moment with the reporter on a tarmac somewhere.
And Mr. Biden, what is your response to the New York Post story about your son, sir?
I know you'd ask it. I have no response. It's another smear campaign. Right up your alley. Those are the questions you always ask.
Now, the Trump guys are watching this on a loop, you know, trying to get Trump to provoke him. But the Biden guys know it's coming. And I think you will see Trump try.
Joe Biden is passionate about his family. I'm sure he is mightily pissed off about not just the story, but the photo of Hunter with a crack pipe or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And the fact that his family had to see that, his grandkids had to see that. And I think he's probably really pissed about it. And probably the most important thing they can do for him in debate prep is to model out how he's going to deal with that. Because he could lose it around that. And, you know, mm-hmm. I thought he was incredibly effective in the first debate.
Yeah.
When Hunter's drug use came up, he said he loves his son and, you know, a lot of families have this problem. I think a lot of people in America embraced that. But what he can't do is just go, you know, postal in a way that you know, causes him to unravel.
The bottom line is that everybody in America, literally everybody in America, has either had an addiction issue or knows someone who's had an addiction issue. Everybody. And everyone who's a parent has had their kid exercise bad judgment at some point. All of these things are properly handled by Joe Biden, work to his advantage. There's literally not a thing about this story that properly handled does not help Joe Biden and does not make him come across as a figure of sympathy with whom everyone in the country will share at least a moment of like, I can relate to that. But that does, as you say, David, it depends on whether he's able to be disciplined. And the one example we have of it so far in that first debate, I thought he was exceptionally good in that moment.
It's easy for jamokes like us to say, hey, play it cool.
No, but he did, though. He did in the first debate.
No, he did. The problem is Trump will do it 30 times and Biden will eventually.
It's going to be ramped up. I just want to say one thing about that story, which, I mean, again, it's been commented on. I'm not going to give it anything in it credit because I think the story's, you know, I called it a radioactive turd the other day on television. But it is amazing to me. I've never seen anything like this. Like, you get to the point where you're out shopping a story like this. You are turned down by Fox News. The only home you can find for it is the New York Post. The New York Post has a newsroom revolt over it, where the story is such that the person who wrote it
wouldn't put
refuses to have a byline on it. And the person whose byline on it had nothing to do with it. There's literally no one in the New York Post newsroom who wants to be anywhere within 10 yards of this story.
So it's really hard for me to understand because it was walked in by the highly credible Rudy Giuliani. So
yeah, with an assist from Steve Bannon. Right?
Where's the bullet, sir? Biden ought to lock a glance on the camera and make a joke about debating a monkey or whatever and just talk to the home camera and let Trump rant and rave. I think Biden was at his best last time when he was doing that. He ought to try to spend about 3/4 of his time doing that in this debate. Time to close the deal.
Okay, then let's take a break right here and we'll be right back. A couple of things happened in Senate races last week that really speaks to how you can really screw yourself with a bad moment. One was in Iowa, where Joni Ernst, who sits on the Ag Committee and is...
Yeah, the old price of soybean trick.
Yeah.
And that comes back every year, price of milk. You know, you think they would know.
Let's just hear it. It was a bad moment.
Thank you very much. I might have missed it, but I don't think you answered my question. What's the break-even price for soybeans in Iowa? You grew up on a farm. You should know this.
I think you had asked about corn, and it depends on.
I asked her corn.
It depends on what the inputs are, but probably about $5.50.
Well, you're a couple dollars off, I think, here because it's 10:05. So, well, we'll move on to something else.
That's the polite Iowa equivalent of you're full of shit, by the way. And David, what's the price of barley? One bushel in the Chicago.
I don't know. I just drink it. I don't weigh it.
Yeah, same here.
But. But you know what? She runs as a farmer's daughter. She's on the ag committee, and her opponent, Teresa.
I'm the
Greenfield,
one who castrates hogs, if you remember.
Exactly. That's how she got elected.
And by the way, she was a few points down before this. So
yeah. Her opponent, Teresa Greenfield, got a comparable question on the price of corn, and she nailed it to the penny with all kinds of explanation about different factors that weigh on it. And if you're a farmer watching that, you're saying, well, damn, she knows this shit. And Joni didn't.
Yeah, she's planning to tax corn, so it's all part of the plan. I owe that to my old political friends in Iowa. David Kochel is probably listening. But rough day for Ernst, classic error.
In Georgia, where David Perdue has a close race against John Ossoff, a Republican incumbent, goes to a Trump rally and gets infected by Trump. Let's listen to that one.
But the most insidious thing that Chuck Schumer and Joe Biden are trying to perpetrate, and Bernie and Elizabeth and Kamala, I don't know. Whatever.
All right, so this guy is in the United States Senate. He sits on a committee with Kamala Harris, knows very well how she pronounces her name, and you know what he was trying to do there.
Yeah, and by the way, he is an asshole in real life.
Yes.
I mean, in the Republican caucus, everybody thinks Cruz is the guy they all hate, which is kind of true.
Yeah,
a lot of people hate Perdue. He's just a jerk.
That's the George Allen thing. That's the macaca moment right there. Another just, you know, letting everybody see the literal, not so little racist that's just behind the curtain in David Perdue.
Could this cause Ossoff to be able to pluck Perdue?
All
right, okay, guys.
Well, he's going to peck away at him here.
But it does go back to the thing you said before, David, which we didn't really follow up on, which is that you're not alone in the Blue Plate Special thing about Georgia. It is the case. I keep hearing, you know, the more I've been in Georgia a couple times this fall, and the closer we get to election day, the more it seems like that. I mean, it's always been the battleground, the reach state that people thought was most likely.
But it's been moving and moving.
It's been moving. It's been moving. Well,
the demography of it, the Atlanta suburbs,
yes,
it's the perfect
exactly.
storm of what the Dems are hoping for. And the Republicans, you've got Perdue, who, you know, again, wants to be Foghorn Leghorn. Another reference for you there. Kenny Delmar, the great radio comic who Warner Brothers stole the character
all
from.
Right, all right.
And you've got Kelly Loeffler, who is an SNL sketch. Who may lose to Collins, the congressman. She may not make it into the runoff, by the way, and he's got his own set of troubles. So on every level, it's kind of a mediocre Republican team.
Well, let's hit the mailbag.
It's Listener Mailbag.
Now, first of all, if you have a question, you can email us at our mailbag, hacksontap@gmail.com. That's hacksontap@gmail.com. And don't forget to rate us on Apple Podcasts or even use the share button to send an episode to somebody you want to irritate. Now, first question. I feel a Chicago fix here, but it's to David from David, voting since 1911. I hear
I
all
so
the
respect
polls.
You. Yeah, go ahead.
Wise David writes. X, you're the best. No, okay. Wise David writes, I hear all the polls described as the opinions of, quote, likely voters, and at the same time predictions that this year's turnout will be unprecedented. Might past history be a poor predictor of likely voters? And if so, how exactly do pollsters correct for the changing composition of, quote, likely voters? Great question.
It is a great question. And polls do modeling, but the likely voter designation, particularly in these public polls, is based on the interest that voters express about the election and about their likelihood to vote. So they'll make adjustments along the way. And I think one thing that's been interesting is there's not that much daylight between likely and registered voters, partly because there is a larger electorate out there. I mean, we have not seen enthusiasm like this ever. And that's been true for weeks and months. People, and you can see it in the early voting line, people are showing up and they're going to vote in this election.
Just in case David, the wise David, the questioner, didn't quite glean from that what they might have, the every pollster has a likely voter screen
So they call somebody, you get a phone call, the pollster calls about people on the phone, you pick up the phone and they ask you some questions about how likely you are to vote. And there's no standard for that. Some of the screens are very loose. Some of the screens are very tight, you know, but you know, the part of the art and science of polling is how good your screen is at determining people who are in fact likely to vote and then turn out to be voters later. You know, in certain places like, you know, polling the Iowa caucuses, you know, the way that you can distinguish between good polls and bad polls is how good the likely voter screens are, the likely caucus voter screens are. So that's the answer of how that's decided. It's not science.
The thing that pollsters have to do is then take that data and make sure their sample conforms to something that reflects history in those in those states. And that is that is part science,
that's more
part
science.
Art. Yep. It's part science, part art.
There used to be a great old trick question, an open end. In other words, they had to name it. They're expensive, so they don't really live anymore in polling. But it was, can you name the two candidates on election day?
Yeah.
And that became a pretty good cut. Now, if you go back in the archives, Gibbs and I did an episode with Democratic super pollster Mark Melman, and he went on a long rant about the likely voter thing and how it can lead you astray. And I highly recommend that.
So Juliet asks, Mike Murphy, I'm in Pennsylvania and see that campaign volunteers devote hours to getting and distributing yard signs. But what do your yard signs really do for presidential candidates who already have name recognition? If you have a yard sign, are you perhaps more likely to donate money or phone bank or register voters? I think we had a question like that recently, but you haven't had a chance to answer it. And as someone who really grew up in a different time, as is reflected in almost everything you say, I thought you might want to comment.
Different time,
on
a different
this.
Universe.
Yes. Okay, spring chicken. You're actually older than I am, and not by a few years.
But Mike, it's not about time. It's that you live in some weird place where, like, it's like the trivia forest or something. it's all this.
Yeah, it's 50s through 80s trivia there's no
archive.
End to it.
It's
the Trivial Pursuit universe.
Okay. All right. Like, get out your pencils and you can learn the answer to this question from Juliet. So what yard signs are really about is the volunteers, because they have to have something to do. Yard signs can be expensive and they're not the most effective thing in the world, but it's impossible not to have them. And you want your troops to be motivated. Now, most yard signs do their best work in somebody's garage because the volunteer agrees to go put up 15, puts up 3, and then the rest go vanish. So, they're hardly a mega weapon. I am very proud that in 1988, I used to deploy in a congressional race in South Bend, Indiana, by the way, home of Mayor Pete, negative yard signs, which we found pretty effective. I was a big fan of those. What was wrong with the opponent, Tom Ward? We had a TV ad with a punchline, and we put the board up on a yard sign. So they're fun. If you got them, put them up. They're not terrible, but they tend to be overrated, and they're by far the most important. The other thing, by the way, when your campaign makes a yard sign, give it a message. Have it lower taxes, vote Lurigan. Something other than just a name and an unreadable logo, which is
I've never seen a negative yard sign before in my life.
I'll send it to you. Here's the story very quickly. Guy flip flopped in a congressional race. He said one thing to the Kiwanis Club, said another thing to the.
Oh man, I think I was in this race.
What is he going to tell the Elks? And we had that yard sign all over the place. Yeah, that was Tom Ward in '88. Jack Holler. Was that you?
I was in there, man.
Oh, okay.
I was in there. That was brilliant. Anyway, Mark. Says with almost every, this is for John Heilman, with almost every piece of data suggesting Republicans are going to get clobbered in this election, how is there so little panic on the right? If the tables were turned and Democrats were down 10 points, there'd be panic on a massive scale on the left. Hey, Democrats are panicking and they're 10 points up. Is this just a matter of Democrats and Republicans being wired differently, or is there something else at play here? And is it actually true? Because I talked to a lot of Republicans privately who are pretty concerned.
Well, I'd say yes and yes, and on both those things. First of all, it is the case that Democrats are congenitally more neurotic than Republicans. Just over the course of my career, I've seen a lot more bedwetting on the Democratic side than on the Republican side as a general thing. Okay,
so
that's
true.
The first thing. The second thing is it's something specific, which is that for this crop of Republicans, they, you know, in the same way that Democrats suffer from PTSD in 2016, Republicans suffer from the reverse PTSD. There's a lot of Republicans who walk around in a very high, the MAGA Republicans walk around in a highly overconfident state, which is like you mainstream media jagoffs told us, you know, that Hillary was going to win. And it was certain. It was a done deal back in 2016. And look, our guy won. And they used that one, what we would all call Donald Trump pulling an inside straight, that they think that proves the point that polls are not reliable and the conventional wisdom is not reliable. And so they think that Trump will be able to do it again. He did it once. Why not this time? And then the third point that David raised, which is like, it's not that Republicans aren't panicking. They are just better about not talking about it to the press, which is, you know, Democrats are more neurotic and more gabby, and Republicans are a little less neurotic and a lot less gabby about it. So you don't see that kind of like outbreaks of bedwetting in public. They just manage to keep their bedwetting to themselves. But there's a lot of it going on right now in the Republican ranks, as witnessed by, you know, we've cited some of these examples, but it's still my favorite right now, John Cornyn. You know, John Cornyn distancing himself from Donald Trump this last week is, you know, that's what passes for bedwetting in the Republican Party. That's like
number two guy in the Senate, or number three
from Texas.
From Texas,
Republican. Should be very safe.
Speaking of gabby Republicans, what do you say about this, Murphy?
You're really doing your Alan King routine tonight to do another old reference.
Well, you've been doing Groucho all day, No,
he's got the Groucho stash, or he used to in the brave years.
Used to, yes.
All right, so here's my view on this. All right, Heilman. I am speaking.
Appreciating you. All right.
When you're done, I've got insights. Okay, here we go. So it's the Republicans are a war between the mathematicians and the priest. The mathematicians, which are a lot of the insiders and the look at the demography, look at the data, and say, we're fucked. The priests say, you said that last time. We said a big lightning bolt would hit that tree on the right, and you laughed at us. And then an hour later, the bolt hit, and now Trump's president. So they have the anecdotal. And because people live in bubbles now in America, a lot of the MAGA people, everybody they know other than their irritating daughter-in-law, are all voting for Trump. So it feels the same. The 43% feels like the 43%, and they see the rallies on TV, and they remember the surprise. And so it's very easy to be in kind of a bubble. Now, when you get to the professionals in the Republican Party, there's a subclass that are like Trump-enabling, you know, dregs who can kind of work themselves into a frenzy based on like rally turnout. But the pros all know this is terrible. And when you talk to Republican consultants behind the scenes, it is Stalingrad, man. They're eating horse meat trying to figure out how to put on a dress and escape. So it's just, and you're right about the gabbiness too. And there's a conservative echo chamber. You can go talk to Fox and tell them things are doing great. And our goats are, and the base goats are all listening to Fox, hearing that Sean Hannity says the Snorgas poll shows a surging in Minnesota.
But this is why they're so hostile to regulation, so that they can eat the horse meat at times like this. So.
It really is. It's also really true. It's really funny you say that, Mike, because the reality is that there's the incentive structure set up this way too. You know, if you go on MSNBC as a Democrat and predict doom, you'll get endless airtime. You can get booked on any show on MSNBC to go out and say things are like that and be nervous and neurotic. On Fox News, it's the opposite, right? If you go out and predict that Trump's going to lose, you're banished from air. Whereas if you go on and say everything's fine, Donald Trump's on his way to securing yet another shocking, you know, shock the world, come from behind victory, you'll again get massive airtime. But if you went on Fox News and said Trump's going to lose, you'd be banished. That'd be it. You'd be
out. Here's a word for the priests. On the Republican side, there are a bunch of trees that have fallen in 2020. They've all fallen on Donald Trump. And time, there's 14 days left. An errant tree can fall in a different direction, but it doesn't feel like divine intervention here is going to save him in 2020.
Yeah, I think the priests are going to literally have a religious experience on Election Day, but we'll find out.
All right, guys, we will see. 14 days left. Should be fun. Heilman will be watching you on the circus. We'll talk to you soon. Murphy, I will see you shortly.
After the debate with Mr. Robert Gibbs, will we take apart the last debate as the nation cheers?
Yep. Gentlemen, I haven't had this much fun since I don't know when. Talk to you later.
All right, see ya. Bye.
See you guys. Bye.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments. River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.